Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ukraine's prime minister saying Russian military aircraft have violated his country's airspace. And President Obama warning North Korea against nuclear tests. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Ukraine's prime minister says Russian military aircraft have repeatedly crossed into Ukraine's airspace in what he called Russian aggression designed to undermine global security.
Russian military aircraft today at night crossed and violated Ukrainian airspace for 7 times.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk speaking from Rome, Italy, where he met briefly with Pope Francis, but said he would have to cut those meetings short to return to his country. The pontiff told Yatsenyuk he would do everything possible to promote peace in Ukraine. The Ukrainian prime minister then offered this assessment of Russian actions toward his country.
It's clear that Russian aggression has its aim to undermine the global security and global stability, to redraw the lines and to revise the consequences of the Second World War.
Russia's envoy to the Vienna-based Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe said today Russia will take all possible measures to free more than a dozen OSCE monitors seized Friday near the town of Slavyansk. Andrei Kellen told Russian news agencies the monitor team needed to be freed as soon as possible. Slavyansk's self-declared mayor, meantime, said the group was detained because a Ukrainian military official was traveling with them. The group of 7 major economies, meantime, has agreed to move swiftly on new sanctions against Russia because of Russia's actions in Ukraine. Ukraine's deputy foreign minister said Friday that he's worried that Russia plans to invade his country. Margaret Bashir reports for VOA at the United Nations.
Dan Lolubkivsky said his country is facing an enormous threat and questioned how many troops Russia has put on his country's doorstep.
Yes. We have the information that we are endangered.
Speaking to reporters at the United Nations in between meetings with UN officials and other diplomats, the deputy foreign minister said Kiev fears a further military move by Moscow.
We do hope.
Minister Lubkivsky also strongly condemned the detention of a group of international monitors by pro-Russian separatists. The United States has warned that it will impose more targeted sanctions in response to Russia's latest actions. Russia has said it is acting to protect Russian speakers and citizens in Ukraine. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
President Barack Obama is in Malaysia. It's the first visit by a sitting U.S. president since 1966, when President Lyndon Johnson traveled there. Before departing from South Korea today, Mr. Obama spoke to American troops stationed in Seoul, telling them that the U.S. will not hesitate to use military might to defend our allies and our way of life.
And I want to be clear, the commitment that the United States of America has made to the security of the Republic of Korea only grows stronger in the face of aggression. Our alliance does not waver with each bout of their attention seeking. It just gains the support of the rest of the world. North Korea's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons is a path that leads only to more isolation. It's not a sign of strength. Anybody can make threats. Anyone can move an army. Anyone can show off a missile. That doesn't make you strong. It does not lead to security or opportunity or respect.
The president's comment comes amid threats by North Korea to conduct its 4th nuclear test. North Korea says it has detained an American tourist on April 10th for a gross violation of its laws. The official KCNA news agency reported 24-year-old Miller Matthew Todd tore up his visa while entering North Korea and that he was seeking shelter in the country. The news agency said officials are investigating the tourist's rash behavior going through immigration. The U.S. State Department says it is aware of the report and has been in touch with Sweden, which acts on behalf of cases involving Americans in North Korea. The mother of a Somali-American boy who stowed away in the wheel well of a plane that flew over the Pacific says her son was trying to reach her in Africa. Uba Muhammad Abdullahi said she was very shocked by her son's ordeal and how he risked his life. Abdullahi says she knew he was looking for her and she's requesting the U.S. government to help reunite her with her children. Iraqi officials say at least 28 people have been killed and dozens wounded in a series of bombings at a campaign rally for a Shiite political organization just days before the country's parliamentary elections. Blasts on Friday struck as some 10,000 supporters of the group gathered for a rally at the sports stadium in eastern Baghdad. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News in Washington. More news, voanews.com.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
I really like it because it shows where we come from, how we started, and our togetherness in this whole matter. So it makes us feel great, and we real wish for it to always remain there.
Tanzanians mark 50 years as a nation.
And the whole idea is to try and prepare an outcome document related to the summit of heads of state in September, which is going to look at employment, poverty eradication, and inclusive development issues.
A special session of the African Union concludes in Windhoek, Namibia, with a plan of action on employment, poverty eradication, and inclusive development.
Malaria in Niger, as in many African countries, is a main cause of morbidity and mortality in children under 5. So prevention, of course, prevents that the child gets sick. So then, logically, it decreases the morbidity and mortality due to malaria.
And a new technique for fighting malaria is rolled out in countries across the Sahel. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
The Eastern African country of Tanzania is marking its 50th anniversary Saturday. On April 26, 1964, shortly after gaining independence from Britain, two countries in the Great Lakes region, Coastal Tanganyika and the Archipelago Zanzibar, merged to form one nation. Later that same year, the two combined their names into a new one, Tanzania, with TN from Tanganyika and ZAN from Zanzibar. Latika Hawk looks into how the country has fared since then.
Pristine waters and fine sand beaches attract tourists from around the world to Zanzibar Island, but some come to learn about the dark part of its history. Zanzibar was one of the world's last open slave trade markets.
People used to make a lot of money through slave trade, and the country became very wealthy. And the slaves used to work very hard in the spice plantation until in 1873, when the trade was abolished.
Today, gold production and tourism form the backbone of Tanzania's economy, but the country is working to diversify. This past week, the capital, Dar es Salaam, hosted an information and communications technology summit. The Minister of Communication, Makame Mbarawa, said regional government and industry representatives gathered to discuss opportunities the field has to offer for their people.
ICT is very important in development and social development of our people. You know, everything has changed now. Everything, if you want to do, you need to do is with ICT. ICT is not just a tool. ICT itself is a very important tool for social and economic development.
But as the weak government struggles to pull the nation out of poverty, growing incidences of violence from radical Islamists may discourage tourists from visiting Tanzania's great national parks or its attractive coasts. Once an island of religious tolerance, Zanzibar has seen a spate of church burnings and violent attacks in recent months. During his regular morning run, moderate Muslim cleric Sheikh Fadil Soraga was attacked by an unidentified assailant with acid.
Then I was coming across him. He threw me an acid on my face. He targeted the eyes. Of course, he got them. And the acid fell straight to the eyes and fell down to the neck, burning the chest. It was a very, very, very serious attack on me.
As they celebrate their country's anniversary, some Tanzanians worry about the future of their country.
This celebration tomorrow is coming during the time where there's many challenges and many talks about the union.
I really like it because it shows where we come from, how we started, and our togetherness in this whole matter. So it makes us feel great, and we real wish for it to always remain there together.
Analysts say that radical Islam has not taken hold in Tanzania, but warn that an unstable government, poverty and unemployment could turn many young people to extremism. Slavica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
Doctors Without Borders says a new technique of fighting malaria with preventative drug treatments, now being rolled out in countries across the Sahel, can reduce malaria cases by up to 83% in children under five. The doctors group says the drug used in this chemo prevention program does have some shortcomings, but it is a simple and effective preventative measure, particularly in rural areas where treatment is not easily accessible. Jennifer Lazuta has more from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
International medical organization Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, says that seasonal malaria chemo prevention campaigns, known as SMCs, could help to reduce the number of malaria deaths among children under the age of five in the Sahel. The full course of treatment consists of intermittent doses of tablets to children during malaria seasons, and thus prevents new cases in countries where the mosquito-borne illness is endemic. The World Health Organization, WHO, says more than 620,000 people worldwide died from malaria last year. The majority of the victims were children in sub-Saharan Africa, where less than 50% of the population has access to insecticide-treated bed nets. Millions more in Africa do not have access to malaria testing or treatments. Elena Koskalova, an epidemiologist and malaria expert for MSF, spoke to VOA from Niger, where MSF carried out a pilot SMC campaign during last year's malaria high season.
Malaria in Niger, as in many African countries, is a main cause of morbidity and mortality in children under five. So prevention, of course, prevents that the child gets sick. So then, logically, it decreases the morbidity and mortality due to malaria.
During 4 months last year, Koskalova says more than 200,000 children between the ages of 3 months and 5 years from more than 1,000 villages in Niger received a course of antimalarial tablets during the height of the country's malaria season. MSF says the number of cases of both simple and severe malaria decreased by more than 80% in the areas where children received SMC treatment. The WHO first recommended SMC treatment in 2012, but is only now starting to gain popularity in other African countries, such as Mali and Chad, where similar successes have been seen. Koskalova says the SMC treatment costs an estimated $4 per child per season. Less than 1% of those who receive the treatment experience mild side effects, such as vomiting. Despite the successes of SMC, Koskalova said it is important to remember that this strategy alone does not prevent all cases of malaria.
The SMC preventive treatment, it's not a miracle cure. So it means it's part of a package of malaria preventive and curative strategies. So it means it cannot stand alone. So as I already told you, some children were already sick at the time of SMC distribution. So of course, for these children, it's essential to have access to diagnostic and treatment.
Niger's Ministry of Health is now including SMC in its 2014 National Malaria Control Program, following last year's success. MSF hopes to treat 400,000 children in Niger this year, starting in July. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
A special session of the African Union, a Labour and Social Affairs Commission, has concluded in Windhoek, Namibia, with a plan of action on employment, poverty eradication and inclusive development. The conference was attended by ministers of Labour and Social Affairs and their social partners. Ernest Chuma is the International Labour Organization Assistant Director General and Regional Director for Africa. I reached him in Windhoek just before the conference closed and began by asking him about the highlights of the conference.
It's a special session organized by the African Union, its Labour and Social Affairs Commission. And it's meant for ministers of Labour and Social Affairs and their partners, social partners in terms of employers, as well as workers' organizations. And the whole idea is to try and prepare an outcome document related to the Summit of Heads of State in September. which is going to look at employment, poverty eradication, and inclusive development issues. In terms of the process here, we've had an expert meeting looking at the various issues around these three areas of work, employment, poverty reduction, and there's inclusive development. And now the ministers are finalizing the statement and agree on the priorities, which will then be taken up to the heads of state in September. And then thereafter, there is a new declaration.
See, you mentioned poverty and unemployment, but let's talk more about unemployment, especially youth unemployment.
Yes.
It's the figures are so high. Is this how did it get to this?
Well, I think you have to understand that the African population demographics indicate that it's a very young population. Probably 60-70% of the population is less than the age of 30. So it's a very young population. Now, we have to look at it constructively and regard this as a tremendous resource that needs to be tapped. Or if you just ignore it and the cost alone, it could be also a major source of instability socially, especially if the young people don't see opportunities and they have no prospects. So the reason why the numbers are so high is precisely because the growth of the labor force is far outstripped the growth of employment generation. In other words, the capacity of the formal sector to generate jobs, to absorb the large numbers of unemployed school leavers. It's a global problem, by the way, but it's much particularly sharp in Africa where the population is very young.
Many African countries lately boast of high economic growth figures and correspondingly suffer high youth unemployment. How do you reconcile those two facts?
I think what you say is correct. Particularly over the last 10 years, the African countries have demonstrated growth, and in some cases, double-digit growth. In a lot of cases, this has enabled them to weather the external shocks of the financial and economic crisis that started in 2008. But you have to then unpack, you know, the nature of that growth. And then you realize that a lot of the growth was driven by the export of primary products and extractive, you know, minerals. And that those ordinarily don't generate too much employment because mining, you know, particularly commercial mining, is a very capital-intensive operation. It doesn't generate that many jobs, as it were. They use huge excavators and all. The problem is that the nature of the growth, which was resource-driven, did not, you know, generate enough jobs to absorb the large numbers of young people looking for work. That's the main reason. To change that, there's need for much more focus on, for example, manufacturing as well as industrialization.
Whatever resolutions come out of this session will be forwarded to the heads of state, as you say. Similar resolutions have been passed and before. Do you feel, is it your opinion that there is political will and commitment to implement whatever is agreed upon?
I totally agree, I think, with what you say. The political will has always been there, but often what has been lacking is the resources and the institutional infrastructure and the institutional capacity to implement some of these recommendations. I think going into the summit in September, I think we're going to see that there will be declarations, but there will also be mechanisms to implement and monitor and account for results, because I think the matter is urgent. All African countries face it, and there's really a desire to try and make a difference, to try and invest. And in fact, it's not like nothing's happening. You do see considerable innovative ways of promoting investment through infrastructure, through special funds and facilities to encourage young people to get into entrepreneurship. I think what is required is scaling up and also due diligence in making sure that you make this long-term investment. It's not a once-off thing.
Aeneas Chuma, the International Labour Organization Assistant Director General and Regional Director for Africa. I reached him earlier in Windhoek, Namibia.
The World Bank has approved $150 million to finance 19 university-based centers of excellence in seven countries in West and Central Africa. The project aims to attract students who wish to enroll in advanced specialized studies such as science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I spoke with the World Bank Education Manager for Western Central Africa, Peter Montero, who noted that the current development growth in Africa is mostly fueled by commodity prices and sale of minerals. But there are quite a few countries in Africa that can compete in the global market.
If you look at what is fueling the current growth in Africa, it is more about commodity prices. It is about selling oil and gas and other kinds of minerals. But we have very few countries, maybe South Africa to some extent, are moving to that higher level where they can produce products and services that can compete in the global market. That's one side of it. The second side of it, which is also equally important, is the challenges that we have in the region in terms of the health indicators, the education indicators, the environmental and climate related issues. And the question is, what does it take to find solutions to this challenge? We have very few doctors. We have very few engineers. And if you look at the system that is producing these people, which is essentially the tertiary education system, you see that there are big challenges in quality, very few faculty in the universities, and very few students who are opting to go into the sciences. So how can we support our countries in Africa to address these challenges and have tertiary education play its role in producing that human capital that you need to help Africa address these socioeconomic challenges?
How were the centers of excellence selected?
We worked with a group of counterparts in the region to agree on criteria. There was a call for proposals, which was advertised by the Association of African Universities. About 52 institutions submitted proposals. The second one was to constitute an international panel of experts to do the evaluation. And this panel was constituted again in consultation with the counterpart group. And it's a mix of experts in the three areas that I mentioned, from Africa, from outside Africa, some of them Africans in the diaspora. So a group of 44 people, and this went through a three-stage process. The first one is to have a desk review of the proposals. The second stage is a panel evaluation of the proposals. The third stage was to visit the institutions that had sent the proposals. And it was on that basis that the selection was then made.
Now, walk me through the application process for students. How can a student apply to get into one of those institutions to participate in the Africa Centers of Excellence project?
These institutions are institutions that already exist in the country. And so the application process will be managed by the countries themselves. However, the understanding that we have with these institutions is that they will be recruiting not only from their own country, but that they will be recruiting region-wide. And so the application will be open. And so students in any country will see the call for admissions when it comes out, and they will be free to apply, and then the assessment will be done. The agreement is that the students participating in this program will be at least 30% coming from other countries.
Will students attend through gaining scholarships and grants, or will they be expected to pay tuition?
It will be both, and we understand that for some of these centers, they have actually included within the application some funding for scholarships. But we are also encouraging them to work with the industry and other partners to secure more scholarships for students to attend. And we are working in parallel to see if we could develop a scholarship fund that would support this kind of initiative. But we are not yet there with that one.
When will the project become fully operational?
Typically, the bank provides 90 days within which the institutions are expected to do what is necessary for them to start drawing on their resources. We have seven countries, 19 institutions, and we are working with each of these countries to provide support for them to get ready. Our team is heading out already end of next week to start intensive support to countries to get ready for effectiveness. And we hope that by the end of this 90 days, most of the countries, if not all, will be ready to start.
The World Bank Education Manager for Western Central Africa, Peter Montero.
The U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, will leave Tuesday to meet heads of state in three African countries. Kerry will travel to Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola to discuss peace efforts in the region. The U.S. State Department spokesperson, Jen Psaki, said on the five-day trip, Kerry will meet President Hailemariam Desalegn and Foreign Minister Tedros Adhanom in Addis Ababa to discuss regional peace efforts. Ethiopian troops are a major factor in Somalia's recent campaign against Al-Shabaab rebels, and Ethiopia is hosting struggling peace talks between neighboring South Sudan government and its rebel forces. In Kinshasa, diplomatic talks will focus on President Kabila's continuing efforts to neutralize remaining rebel groups that have devastated eastern portions of that country for many years. Kerry will also meet with the Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos in Luanda to commend him on his engagement in the peace process in Africa's Great Lakes region.
Human rights groups say attacks against Christians in the Middle East have multiplied in the aftermath of the Arab Spring and are triggering an exodus from the region. Activists in the U.S. say President Barack Obama is not doing enough to address the problem. VOA correspondent Jerome Sokolowski reports.
Last year, the bloody crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood protest camp in Cairo drew international condemnation. But less attention was paid to the many Egyptian churches that were attacked in the days that followed. In Iraq, Christians number about a third of the pre-U.S. invasion population, and there are fears the same will happen in Syria, where a group of nuns was recently kidnapped and released. Congress has held hearings on the persecution of Christians, and one looking at Egypt was chaired by Representative Christopher Smith.
We are witnessing grievous violence and other abuses directed against religious and political minorities, particularly the Copts and other Christians, about which our government and the media has said far too little.
Thank you, please. At the National Prayer Breakfast in February, President Barack Obama's speech was about religious freedom abroad.
No society can truly succeed unless it guarantees the rights of all of its peoples, including religious minorities. Whether they're Ahmadiyya Muslims in Pakistan, or Baha'i in Iran, or Coptic Christians in Egypt.
We're really encouraged because at the prayer breakfast, he came out with a very strong statement. It was very encouraging. But you look at the follow-up to that, and there hasn't been any.
Lobbyist Jeff King says Christians are persecuted around the world, and President Obama should act.
He's very vocal on the subject of persecution of the gay community.
But King says the president did not even bring up discrimination against Christians in his meeting with King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, where churches are banned. U.S. foreign policy already prioritizes minority rights, says former Mideast envoy Dennis Ross. But he says the plight of Christians might need a special focus.
If there's concern it hasn't been addressed enough, that in itself suggests that maybe it should be addressed more.
But activists concede it's hard to press the issue because in the West, Christians are not widely seen as a vulnerable minority. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou.
Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners...
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still to come in this program, we shall have the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Then have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
It's now time for our Saturday Music Spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
I'm sorry, Lulingo Testinga. Naye Katinchi Ulida, Kapoya Fe Machinga. Anyway, Wagaliza, Wagaliza, Wagaliza Luna Kolulu,
Luna Kolulu,
Mayori Nalinze. Quagaliza, quagaliza, luna kolulu.
Soluna kolulu. Oh, my baby.
mungi utuse kuntobo yomutima gwange weluba luimba ukubye hitiko imbye kakuteyo obusimusimu bw'omubiri gwange bunagukwesunga oluyimba lw'obwe kiba kivulu tulolinde bantu mu kikali bwe kuba kulanga by'otunda nze ne wange nayitisedda simanyi na bwe biwoma zinaye nanga yebinjagaziza kwesunga nnyo mperekerako abatusanga batusange nishauri yawo oba batulopa batulope esengeka y'ebigambo byendowooza sezanga takyali ku nsi mperekerako onotuusa gye ngenda nange nakuza
tugende bwe nakutuusa nawagomyewo bena tugende oba tusulamu oba tusulemu mumomukwano gw'okwesunga sifayo oba bucya ne bucya
mperekerako onotuusa gye ngenda nange nakuza njagala ntandikire mama ne tata we bakoma bo balowooza nti okuze nnyo zikulaba ukyalimu ekyejo bo bandaba okyetaaga kulerebwa ng'omwana wetaaga kuwekebwa nga bebi okyetaaga ennywa ntongo omwana nja kuyimbira ng'obuyimba bwe bayimbira abaana abatonga gwe tengerere omwana ayimiridde tulo tulo kwata omwana simbula tambula nali nepanka nnyo mutali mulenzi alimpangula naye omwana ono era mmadde n'ensonyi nnyingi ng'okunjogerako nti njagala gundi ng'ekyo kinkaabya naye omwana ono ne bwonjogerera kale nsanyuka busanyusa kusasulira ne rediyo mwogere mwogere mperekerako oba batusanga batusange nishauri yawo oba batulopa batulope tugende
bena tugende oba tusulamu oba tusulemu kuma mukwano gw'okwesunga sifayo oba bucya ne bucya
mperekerako onotuusa gye ngenda nange nakuza badde ntambula bomu nga ne mukkubo ntyamu naye kati mperekera mukwano otuuse waka
sente bwetutyo mugwanya wabwe sina bwendi
Dale, Olinda. Amazonia, Bachala, Vacina, Vallare. Dale, Olinda.
Yeah, that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. When we talk about good governance, this is a perennial question. It's going to be on the table of all the African leaders from this day to the summit and beyond the summit. And the new developments in different African countries are going to affect how Africans are going to relate to the summit and beyond the summit. When one talks about the Obama doctrine with regard to the African continent, this forthcoming summit is just going to be part of a larger equation on the policies, programs, and approaches of the president. Good governance becomes problematic because the political developments in individual African countries are just part of the larger algebraic equation. If you look at Angola and you go all the way to Zimbabwe and all the countries alphabetically between A to Z, you can see that the Obama policy is going to be affected by the oil issues of Angola, the oil issues in Gabon, Cameroon, and all the other African countries that are now in intimate relationship with the United States with regard to oil. So when we talk about the summit, the oil issue is going to be very much on the table because those African countries that produce oil, and the number is increasing. In West Africa, you do have a large number of the West African countries that are becoming to join partners with Nigeria in terms of oil production. Nigeria is part of OPEC, and of course, they have been very much involved with OPEC policies and all the oil issues. So when it comes to good governance, the question of U.S. policies towards Africa are going to be very much affected. As we move towards August, the oil issue is going to be affected by international developments. U.S. policy towards Asia is going to be linked very much to the oil question. And in this regard, when American policy is made, the question of oil and the role of oil in the international political development will be paramount. Now, as we look around the world, good governance is going to be looked at because the political state of affairs in individual countries around the world will be very much affected by what is going on in terms of oil prices, oil consumption, the role of oil in economic development. For Africa today, when we talk about the Obama administration and the Obama doctrine and the implication of an Obama doctrine for Africa, the question of power, energy, electricity would be very important. Those African countries with oil are in a good position if they have oil refineries at home or they develop programs of interaction among African states with regard to oil use and industrial development. This is how good governance is going to be very much linked to the power policies of individual African countries. If the African countries are going to industrialize and they are in intimate relations with the United States, we have a new day, new approaches, new programs of action. So for this and other related reasons, it makes sense to focus on good governance. if there is no good governance in any of these individual African countries, you are going to battle between political tyranny, the struggle for human rights, and the struggle for economic development. All these three struggles are going to come together, and they are going to affect American policy towards Africa, or America's role in Africa. And that's one of the reasons why how African governments address the question of natural resources on the ground and how these natural resources are deployed in the service of economic development. They return to America for two or three reasons. One is post-colonial relationship with the United States and all the benefits that derive from that relationship. They may turn to America because they are being lured by the Chinese and other Asian or Latin American powers or European powers. For these and other related reasons, it makes sense to talk about good governance. If you don't have good governance, it is becoming problematic for the newly created state of South Sudan, you are going to have a problem, because even if the new state has oil resources, those resources are not going to be fully deployed in the service of economic development. And this is how U.S. policy towards Africa and African opinions on and attitudes of the United States come together. If you have good governance and the leadership is genuinely interested in economic development for their people, they will make sure that their society is stable, and with stability, they will be able to produce what is badly needed by their people. This is how transparency comes back to the equation. And the U.S. government is going to be looking at the African countries and see how the political leaders are really negotiating these difficult territories of political stability on the one hand, and transparency in politics and in economic development on the other.
That commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As intercommunal fighting continues to roil the Central African Republic and the resulting humanitarian crisis worsens, the United States is increasing its engagement to help end the violence and restore legitimate governance there. W. Stuart Symington, a veteran Foreign Service officer with extensive experience in Africa, has been named to serve as U.S. Special Representative to the CAR. Previously stationed in Rwanda, Niger, and Djibouti, among other postings, he will play a leading role in shaping and coordinating U.S. strategy toward the CAR to end the violence, address humanitarian needs, and, with our regional and international partners, help move the nation toward an inclusive political transition process leading to democratic elections early next year. In this capacity, he will work closely with the African Union, the European Union, and United Nations, which are also deeply engaged there. The appointment of a special representative follows several steps our nation is taking to address the critical needs in the CAR. The U.S. committed $100 million this year to support African Union and French forces working to restore security there. This is in addition to nearly $67 million in humanitarian aid and $7.5 million for conflict mitigation and human rights programs. Ultimately, however, the people of the CAR hold their future in their own hands. We continue to urge all parties to end the violence, establish judicial mechanisms for ensuring accountability for those suspected of perpetrating human rights abuses, and move ahead toward a better future for their nation and people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.